Welcome to Leadership Unscripted. This episode features Darden professor Laura Morgan Roberts in conversation with incoming Wharton School Dean Erica James and Airbnb Head of Global Diversity and Belonging Melissa Thomas Hunt. In this podcast, they will discuss the state of diversity and inclusion efforts in the workplace, leadership opportunities and challenges for people of color, and the power of difficult conversations.
We are so thankful for the opportunity to share this space and to take up such an important conversation around creating organizations and societies that are more inclusive, more equitable, more just, and of course, more diverse. Though diversity has always been among us, the issue has been what we're doing with and to the diversity that is among us. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time this evening first just having an unscripted conversation with a little bit of a script around our central question for tonight, which is what's holding businesses back from achieving diversity and inclusion in the workplace? And we don't take for granted the opportunity to have this conversation. We don't take for granted the opportunity to have the conversation in this space. Darden Sands Family Grounds, breaking new ground in the DC metro area. We're so grateful to the entire team here, to Laura Martins, to Greg Fairchild, to our catering staff and all of the support personnel who have just welcomed us so warmly. And we hope that you will be back here. We have lots of wonderful things that we're offering here. Please let this be the first of many times that you come and engage with us. So we don't take for granted the place in which we're in. We also don't take for granted the moment in which we come together. It's timely on a number of levels. It's timely as we transition from Black History Month to Women's History Month to have this conversation among three individuals who have thought for a little bit of time around some of the issues about diversity and inclusion, but who also happen to be three African American current and former women faculty of the Darden School. And we don't take for granted the fact that this is the eve of a celebration in Charlottesville, where many of our friends are listening in on simulcast. Let's say hi to all of our Charlottesville friends. Hey! And in Charlottesville, tomorrow on March 3rd, has been marked a commemoration of Liberation and Freedom Day, which is a day that marks the official end of slavery in Charlottesville when the Union troops arrived. And so in lieu of celebrating the birth of Mr. Jefferson, there will be a series of events that focus on the practices and the process and the trials of liberation. That's personally meaningful to me, being the great, 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 great granddaughter of former cooks at the University of Virginia, who also graduated from UVA, Wahoo, in 96. So lots of homecomings, prescient time, and then just to shout out one more time, the remarkable and dynamic year that Melissa Thomas Hunt and Erica Hayes James have had, just going from already dynamic leadership positions, Dean of Emory Gazueta, Vice Provost of Vanderbilt, moving on to Head of Global Diversity and Inclusion at Airbnb and the Dean of the Wharton School. This is the time to celebrate. So, we're gonna start with our unscripted script. But the first question is, what is the word on the street about diversity and inclusion challenges? You know, as you move through your leadership roles, what do you often hear as people naming and expressing the most significant challenges that they're facing in helping our businesses and our schools and organizations to become more diverse and more inclusive? And then, of course, how would you critically challenge what they're saying?
So I think the obvious one is they we just don't exist. There aren't enough of us. They're too few, followed by there are too few qualified, mm-hmm. which is, to me, the most insidious of all of the excuses that are provided.
Followed by they're just not a good fit mm-hmm. for this environment. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which then is followed by, so for us to bring more of them into our spaces, that would require us to lower our standards. And we don't want to do that, right? Because there just aren't that many, and they might not be a good fit. And so the question of change and inclusion becomes framed as a question of accommodation rather than a question of enhancement and strengthening and amplifying. So how do we help people to reframe? How do we channel some of the strength and the power and the potential of diversity while challenging some of those assumptions that people call forth so frequently now?
So it's really challenging because it's effortful and it takes sustained commitment and it takes having a path that is not just about inviting a few people in here and there, having great speakers, but it's really about understanding the processes by which individuals enter the organization, be it an educational institution or a corporate entity. How do they come in? How do they find us? How do we find them? What environment are we actually bringing them into? What is their experience as they come in? Are they being embraced? What information are they being given? Are they being given the feedback that they actually need? Or are they struggling to make sense because everyone is telling them they're doing just fine until they're not? Mm-hmm. And so part of it is really understanding the processes that are not friendly and are often disenfranchising and unpacking those and then beginning to build back up from there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So as dean of the Goizueta Business School at Emory, I was personally confronted with this because when you're the dean, the buck stops with you. So if there's not diversity, there's nowhere else I could look to but myself for why that was in fact the case. So I felt very intimately connected to this work and to the need to make a difference given the role that I had. As was described in the introduction, some of my research early in my career was connected to diversity and inclusion. So there's an expectation that at least theoretically I would know how to bring this about. But theoretically and practically are two very different situations.
Yeah, yes, it is.
When you have an organization where there are not a lot of people of background similar to mine, and as the leader, and I'm a Black woman in leading this institution where there are not a lot of people like me, wanting to come in and try to create a more diverse environment, in my head, what I'm imagining people are saying is, she's just going to create favorites and make us or mandate us to do this work, and it's so that she has a personal agenda that can be fulfilled. And I needed to quell that conversation. So part of the work that I think needs to be done, which is what I tried to do at Emory, was to break down the fear of having the conversation by putting it on the table myself. Because nobody was going to talk about diversity at the business school unless I was the one talking about diversity at the business school. And I remember in faculty meetings sharing my personal story and what it was like for me growing up in a largely segregated community in the South with a stepfather who was white and Jewish. And that got people's attention. And the more I started talking about my story, the more I think people felt comfortable to talk about their story. And so I think that's part of the early work that has to be done to create an environment that would at least allow us to get to what you're talking about, which is breaking down some of the structural barriers and social barriers to doing this work.
Yeah, and then also sort of building the trust that there will be some accountability around whatever initiatives have been put in place because you as the leader have a personal stake in what's happening. You have a deep connection and a passion for the work around diversity and inclusion. And I recall that as being one of the central themes of some of Martin Davidson's research as well on this topic of leveraging difference, which, by the way, we now currently have in the room all three individuals who have held the role of Chief Diversity Officer at the Darden School in the history of the school, Martin being the current and also former. And so, speaking of the work of leading diversity and inclusion in formal ways, so Melissa, you know, Airbnb is a global company. Erica, Emory, and Wharton are global business schools. What are you learning from your conversations around the world about the current socio-political climate, the current economic climate, and how that shapes the ways that we should be thinking about diversity and inclusion, how we should be talking about them if we really want to achieve whatever aspirations that are being, you know, projected by these organizations?
So one of the things that in the interview, the second interview that I had with the CEO, Brian Chesky of Airbnb, he asked me, what are you going to do in your first 90 days? And I said, I'm going to look at our employee engagement surveys, and then I'm going to see where there are hotspots, and I'm going to go and talk to people and understand what's going on. And he said, where are you going to go? Are you going to go in the United States? Are you going to go outside? And I said, well, I'll do both. Well, where globally? And so we had this banter back and forth. As a result of that, when I was offered and stepped into the role, I knew that it was going to be incredibly important to understand and to translate for individuals how my role as head of global diversity and belonging really had impact in our offices, both in the United States, but also in many, many other countries. And so I started traveling very quickly, because what I knew is that it didn't translate as well. And so I knew, in order to understand what the challenges and opportunities were, that I had to be on the ground and I had to have conversations with individuals. And so I would come in, and they were very polite at first, and they were glad to have, you know, someone from the E team, as we call it, come, but they were really there pro forma. And then I would say to them, so what I'm really interested is in what are the things that get in the way of belonging? And so for us as a company, for our employees, belonging is a very important word, because our mission is to create a world where anyone can belong anywhere. So it has currency. And the moment I asked what gets in the way of belonging, there were a plethora of things that people started talking about. Some that were specific to the local context and had implications. So there were a lot of conversations about class and socioeconomic status and who was represented in our offices and how do you get access and how do we even reach people who otherwise, you know, haven't gone to a certain set of schools. There were lots of conversations about gender and women in particular and their experience. There were conversations about ability, disability, and there were conversations about the LGBTQI+ community, which was a very complicated conversation, because the conversations in the office were often very different from the conversations that could be had outside of the office because of the legality in certain contexts. And so what it made me realize is that belonging is a concept that translates across the globe, and that if what we need to do a better job is understanding, in any sort of geopolitical climate, what are the factors that are dividing people? What are the factors that are giving some people more status and access than others? And that if you ask those questions, then you begin to understand the things that we need to understand and that we need to teach our students and that all of our leaders need to know in order to be successful.
Yeah. I think the thing that we're seeing on college campuses right now is that there are the matters of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging that we're familiar with from the past decades worth of experience and research. But layer on top of that now this movement towards nationalism, which I think is just another complicating factor that's creating tension and divide. And so we're seeing, at least on campuses that I've been familiar with, not only ongoing tensions around race as we tend to define it in the U.S., but also matters of ethnic groups from across the world, which oftentimes are very much tied to religion. And so that is just continuing to make the work that we're trying to do even more relevant and germane and pertinent. And I think it continues to go back to, we have to learn how to have civil discourse with each other so that we can, in fact, work across difference. Martin and I, several years ago, wrote a book chapter on building relationships across difference. And so much of it is about the interpersonal you and me who are different in some dimension coming together and telling each other's story and having that level conversation. And once you start to get to know one another, then you can broaden the conversation with either more people or with more complexity in terms of the kinds of differences that are being bridged. And I think we have to, it's slow, it's not always easy, it's sometimes quite painful, but I think we have to continue to do that. And personally, you're trying to do that in the workplace. I think colleges and universities are absolutely a place where we need to be having those learning moments.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there is some research that reported about 4 or 5 years ago. Johnson and Heckman were the authors of this piece that pointed to a trend in which people are now experiencing diversity and inclusion as happy talk. So people find this space or this way of entering in the conversation that feels very comfortable and very safe and very welcoming. But in that happy talk space, those same individuals also self-report extreme discomfort with talking about race in particular. Mm-hmm. So they're disassociating some of the deeper conflict and the issues that can be more, you know, polarizing and really tap into the fault lines, like race in the US, and disassociating that from these more general conversations about diversity of thought, for instance, or diversity and inclusion. So as we're here on the cusp of Black History Month, Women's History Month, thought it might be helpful for us to just think for a minute, you know, what is the value of calling out some of these intersections around race, gender, class, and other dimensions of difference that help to explain a lot of structural inequalities, you know, over and above the individual experiences of belonging or feeling welcome or feeling included. You know, should we go there? There are many people who say, you know, leave that out. Let's just focus on
happy
the
talk.
Work. Happy talk, yes.
We need to change happy talk to real talk. So I do believe we need to go there. I think we've needed to gone there long before now. The differences and the experiences that people have based on their identity are real. And yes, there are some common grounds that we might be able to come together by looking at universal differences, but so much of what is painful about one's experience is, in fact, because it's connected to a particular aspect of their identity. And if it's race, then for that person to feel heard and understood and respected and regarded in an organization, their racial identity has to be a part of the narrative that they're able to convey. And mm-hmm. their identity has to come forward, which means having real talk about race or about gender or whatever matters to that particular individual.
Yeah.
So I absolutely agree that we have to have the conversations. And as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, whose responsibility is to start the conversation?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that cuts both ways, right? Because you can imagine sitting somewhere and someone who doesn't come in a package like me starts the conversation on race, it might not go so well, right? So we have to be fair in understanding, like, who's going to bring it up, and are the individuals who are most who have the most legitimacy bringing it up, are they also the most vulnerable in initiating the conversation,
right?
Because they don't know how it'll go. And so I think we need to think really hard about. I'm absolutely a fan. I believe in fostering relationships and getting to know individuals and telling stories, but someone has to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I could just share. So I'm thinking back to the years that I was on the faculty at Darden, and we had the unit that I was in, the Leadership and Organizational Behavior Group, was quite diverse. I think at the time we probably had the only African-American faculty at the school. And I'm including strategy in our broader strategy, leadership, organizational behavior. And I remember at some point there were a number of really painful conversations that we had as a small group of faculty around this matter, largely thinking through how we were going to teach a particular case study, particularly with a case study on race or some kind of diversity effort. And over the years, our group got to the point where we could be really candid, and we could joke, and we could say things that many people would see as inappropriate or not politically correct, but we had evolved in our relationship to that point. And it came from sometimes exactly what you're describing, someone saying something that didn't quite go well, and there was a reaction to it. But the thing was, over time, we understood that there was generally no ill will, and it was an opportunity to teach and learn and share and engage at a deeper level. So I understand exactly what you're saying. There's real fear underlying all of this. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really what's driving our inability to have meaningful conversations around diversity. But we also have to open ourselves up to being hurt, mm-hmm. and to feeling pain, so that other people can grow, and in fact, so we can grow from that experience as well.
Yeah, there are actually two other chapters. Like Darden scholars. There's Valerie Purdy Vaughn and Martin Davidson, who contributed a chapter on race intelligent inclusion that speaks to some of these dynamics of what it takes, not just for individuals to get there, but for organizations to essentially create the right containers that, you know, really provides the scaffolding so that these types of conversations can take place and that people feel open and safe to learn and grow from them. And then Courtney McClooney, who's a postdoc at Darden and heading to a faculty position at Cornell. Yes. She and her co-author Veronica Ribello published a piece on that it sort of critically questions whether many of our D&I initiatives and organizations are designed to promote diversity and inclusion or to manage blackness when it comes to race. And thinking about, you know, creating the space for people to learn and grow and bring their full selves versus sort of creating a set of practices that require people to accommodate and assimilate or engage in very intense forms of code switching in order to advance in organizations. So, you know, I think the personal vulnerability and experience is important, but also having that scaffolding within the group, the team, and the institution as a whole is important. That's why we're so fortunate that Erica and Melissa are not just leaders, but they're also thought leaders in this space. So this is beautiful synergy here, and I'm going to ask that they would each speak a little about some of their recent work in this area and how it connects to the conversations that we've been having. So in chapter 17 of Dean James and President-elect.
Thank you.
Lynn, Lynn Perry Wooten, who is currently the Dean of Cornell Dyson School, but on her way to the presidency of Simmons College in Boston. We're so excited. They actually wrote a chapter about what happens when African Americans take on leadership roles at the highest level. And they wrote about glass cliff dynamics. So we're not saying that Wharton's a glass cliff or Simmons a glass cliff. Not what we're saying at all. But if you could explain what you learned from your case study of African-American CEOs and the ways in which they took on these assignments and the implications of taking on those assignments for their careers.
Yeah, so thank you. It's fascinating because the anecdotal evidence would suggest that oftentimes when a woman or a person of color is provided an opportunity that's a very significant opportunity, it's usually at a moment in the organization's history when the organization is at its most vulnerable, when it's mm-hmm. something has happened. And so hence the term glass cliff, because you're really primed to fall off if you don't turn the ship around. And so what has been the case often is that people who are women and minorities, diverse folks of color, will oftentimes come and be provided these opportunities from an outside organization. So they're coming in to the organization where they don't know the people, they don't know the culture, they don't know the issues, they don't know what's going on at a time when the organization is really threatened. So what that means is they also don't have the internal relationships or the support mechanisms or any of the things that they need as they're trying to lead an organization through what is probably its most difficult times. That makes them very vulnerable as leaders. They don't have the network. So some research that I did prior to this one was on sort of the different network types of networks that are developed by people of color and Caucasians in an organizational setting. And the network matters, because if you don't have the support, if you don't have the people who are mentoring and sponsoring you in your organization, they're looking at you prepared for you to make a mistake. And when you are trying to lead at the most critical time in an organization's history, the mistakes will be amplified. Yeah. And you will be seen as the person primarily responsible for not saving the company, even if the company couldn't have been saved regardless. So those people who assume these positions are doing so with great risk. And when you succeed, the opportunities that are afforded for you for your success in those are because you're sort of the second coming in that regard. People couldn't have imagined that you could have turned this around. If you fail, there's no second chance, right? If you're the black football coach and you don't take your team to the Super Bowl, you don't get another head coaching job, which is not the case for others.
Yeah.
So it's a higher risk proposition for people like me mm-hmm. to assume glass cliff assignments.
And so proactively then, what can leaders do, particularly women leaders and minority leaders, when they're taking on assignments, knowing that they're vulnerable, knowing that the challenge may slightly exceed the number of dedicated resources available to deal with the challenge? You know, what are some of the things that they can do to buffer themselves for, you know, whatever the vulnerability might be, but also, you know, more importantly, to increase their chance of success?
Yeah, so I would say two things. On a personal level, I think you need to prepare yourself not to be in that job very long. So whatever you need to, whatever you need to have to be able to walk away and be protected yourself personally, I think that should always be a part of your strategy. Once that is managed, then I do think it is understanding who are the people who are going to be coming after is too strong a term, but for lack of a better one at the moment, who are the people who are going to be most watchful of what you're doing, and how do you bring them into the process so that you're not the only person with accountability? Right? You have to have other people. You have to build your coalition. And doing so at the outset means that you'll likely have people who will have your back and support you through even more turbulence as you're trying to turn the organization around or deal with whatever the challenge is doing, challenge you're dealing with.
I love what you said. My father, many, many years ago, long before Darden, said, you have to know where the door is. Mm-hmm. And have
your exit plan.
I would add who you work for, and that could take many different forms, who you've worked for is incredibly important. And sort of understanding how your future success is linked, or their success is linked to your success, and the ways in which they are willing to shepherd and help you navigate. And if you assess that as part of your decision-making process and entering in, it will lead to more success.
All right, great. We're going to talk a little bit more about other advice and recommendations. I imagine that will come from a lot of the questions that you in the room have. So we're going to plant that seed and then layer a little bit more onto it based on some of Melissa's recent work. So Melissa published a column in the Harvard Business Review Big Idea series on advancing Black leaders, which was published in November of 2019. Courtney McClooney, who I mentioned, also co-authored a piece in this series. So we're really excited to advance the conversation through data. This has really been one of our goals, is to speak to why it can be so challenging for us to have these conversations about race and work and other dimensions of difference, is that oftentimes we come to these conversations through our personal experiences and our beliefs and our judgments, but we don't necessarily have the data to be able to calibrate our own experience against what the group trends may be. Are there truly disparities on some dimensions? Yes, there absolutely are. Ella Washington's research was published in the book using the Gallup data set, almost 20,000 global workers. She, for the first time in history, analyzed it by race. They had this big database, hadn't been analyzed by race. She's an academic who was also working at Gallup. She analyzed it by race. Lo and behold, what did the data show? That there are racial differences in levels of engagement, and they do have implications for career attitudes. So this level of scholarship is really important because it has immediate implications for practice. But one of the other things that Melissa wrote about in her column was the importance of transforming organizational practices. So here's a quote I just want to share because I thought it was so beautifully stated, and then Melissa can expound upon it. She said, "Big wins will come from interrogating seemingly mundane practices and processes and holding managers and leaders accountable for progress toward your organization's aspirations." Can you offer a couple of other examples about some practices that may have been re-examined in your research and some suggestions about how any organization out there might be able to change them?
Sure. And some of this is on the job research, like with my social scientist hat, but looking at it. I've been in academic institutions and then also in my role in a tech company. But I'll start with, there have been academic institutions of which I've been a part where there were anecdotal rumors about disparities between on the basis of race and ethnicity in the performance of students, particularly undergraduates, but no one had looked at the data. And so you have to look at the data, which is an arduous process. And it involves, you know, lots of people doing analyses. It's not particularly sexy, but you look at the data and lo and behold, often the data at multiple institutions, if you look at it, will tell you that there are these divergences. But then you have to further unpack and you have to say, okay, so there are divergences, but is it across the board or are they in particular places? And so looking to see, is it in particular schools or colleges? Is it in particular courses? And so it's, when I say that it's a very methodical, deliberate process that takes time, and a lot of people don't necessarily want to engage that way, but if you do it that way and you actually interrogate where is it that we are having the challenges, then you're better prepared to understand what types of solutions might be needed. Similarly, in the corporate arena, there are multiple ways in which individuals come into the organization by looking at the data and understanding what does the pipeline look like. What does the funnel look like? Where are individuals with certain characteristics falling out of the funnel? Well, why is that? Actually going and talking to recruiters and to HR professionals to understand what is the nature, what are the conversations that are being had? What are the processes? And so it's this interrogation, and you can't fly at 30,000 feet because you don't actually understand what's going on in the ground. And so when I say that, it's looking at all of the critical processes that people need to thrive, to get promoted, to enter in, to learn, and to unpack it and understand how they actually work and see where divergences begin to exist. Yeah.
Okay. She handled it.
All right, I'm going to ask now a personal question. learn a little bit more about Erica and Melissa's journeys and how we can celebrate the full range of their journeys by just knowing a little bit more about their personal stories. And so as you're taking on in the past decade high impact leadership roles and are continuing to assume even higher impact leadership roles with broader, you know, spans of visibility in some of the dimensions and the scope of responsibility that accompanies that. When did you first have that glimmer or that feeling, some might even say a calling, to lead in the ways in which you're leading now? Can you remember when you first got that bug? What was it like? And who or what inspired you at that time?
So I'll start. I have two moments that I'll share. The first one was in 2008. And I was doing a visiting professorship at the Harvard Business School. And up until the moment that I stepped foot in my first class at Harvard, I had this fear about the Harvard MBA student. And I had created this monster-like image of who they were and what my experience in the classroom with them would be, and that it would be very antagonistic, et cetera. So it was all based on stereotype. And I remember August 2008, first class, what happened in the country? So the financial crisis hit, right? And here I am in front of a group of students who had just left really good paying jobs to come to HBS and potentially go into a lot of debt to get this degree. And then there were no jobs guaranteed for them afterwards because their lives had been turned upside down because of the economy. And I remember whatever I thought I was supposed to be in that moment as the teacher in the front of the room, I had to become something very different, because what I had put in my head is these sort of very strong-willed Harvard students were really almost like putty, because they were so fearful about what their future would hold and what decision they had just made to come to this institution. And I realized I have to do something very different to be there for them in a way that they needed, not try to ensure that I was getting through a curriculum. So that's a different kind of leadership, but it was a switch for me to say, I can't pretend to be X when the group that's with me right now needs Y. So I was the one that had to change and realize it. I realized in that moment, that's actually what leadership looked like, yeah. My accommodating what was needed of the group that I was supposed to be with. So that was one. The second moment was probably in 2010, I'd come back to Darden to the faculty, and because of my experience at Harvard the year before, I was very committed to wanting to create a women's leadership program at Darden and in its executive education program. And I remember the flack that I got from other faculty and administrators saying, no, that's never gonna work. Why would you wanna separate women like that? You're gonna make them feel like they're less than and that they need special treatment and da 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 da. And for whatever reason, I had such resolve to sort of get that program done. And as a result of that, fast forward a couple years, I was ended up serving, being invited to serve in the role as the head of executive education at Darden. And I almost turned it down because I did what we read about oftentimes, which is I'm not ready, I don't have enough experience, I've never been a leader like this before, I don't know how to do this, da da da. And then it occurred to me that I had just designed this program and been teaching it for 2 years on women stepping into leadership positions. And how hypocritical would it have been for me not to move forward into an opportunity that was being offered? So that was the second very salient moment that I needed to walk the talk in terms of leadership.
Yeah. Melissa?
So, my earliest recollection is when I was in second grade. And it wasn't a moment that I would have characterized, I mean, then I don't know if I knew what a leader was. I certainly wouldn't have characterized as stepping into leadership, but I knew that the boys had been saying that we couldn't play kickball, we the girls could not play kickball as well as they could. And so I organized the girls to play in a kickball game against the boys, and we lost miserably.
That's not the point.
But the notion was that they thought that we were lesser just on the face of the fact of certain characteristics that we had. And I think that's the earliest memory that I have of wanting to look at injustices or look at to help individuals who are not fully seen for the potential that they can have, and to help elevate them, help others see them for the value that they can bring to the organization. And I think that both through my research, the questions that I asked were ones of trying to elucidate where that wasn't happening. And then once the research got those answers, trying to figure out how in a more applied way can I come up with fixes. And so stepping into those roles to support students and faculty and staff and now employees. But I think that, so the notion of leadership for me is in how do I help others to fully reach their potential.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.